This is Rachel Fields and Sam Swartz with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
The Republican National Convention has released a statement saying they plan to deploy tens of thousands of volunteers as election observers in the battleground states. And Wisconsin is one of their targets, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. While political parties often use election observers, this marks a significant increase in the amount of planned efforts to train and use election observers. Republican officials say the effort is necessary in order to counter Democratic tricks. In a recent training session, a Republican official said that particular focus would be placed on observing Democratic strongholds in the state, including Milwaukee, Eau Claire, and Madison. In the previous presidential election, President Trump falsely accused the Milwaukee election workers of perpetuating the voter fraud in how they counted absentee ballots. When asked about the prospect of new observers, the director of the Milwaukee Election Commission said she was, quote, confident our administration will continue to withstand scrutiny, unquote.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has decided to support a lawsuit that would allow the use of ballot drop boxes in elections in Wisconsin, reports the Capital Times. Ballot drop boxes were widely adopted during the COVID pandemic, but then the Wisconsin Supreme Court, operating under a conservative majority, banned their use in the state in 2022. But control of the court switched in 2023, and a left-leaning nonprofit brought suit, hoping to overturn the ban. Call joins Governor Tony Evers in supporting the lawsuit, saying that election officials are empowered to select tools that they think will facilitate election participation.
The Milwaukee-based nonprofit Souls to the Polls has called for the removal of the Republican Party of Wisconsin's new executive director, Andrew Iverson. That comes after a report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel revealed troubling text messages between Iverson and Republican operative Carlton Huffman. In the messages, Iverson asked Huffman to inundate Souls to the Polls with fake requests for car rides to election sites, which is one of the services the nonprofit offers. In a statement, Iverson said that the text messages were meant as jokes. Souls to the Polls focuses on increasing election turnout among Black voters, a voting bloc that tends to trend Democratic toward Democratic candidates. Other Republican officials have come under fire for actively trying to suppress Black voter turnout in Milwaukee. That includes the Wisconsin Election Commissioner Bob Spindell, who faced calls to resign last year after he said he was proud that voter turnout was low in Milwaukee during the 2022 midterms.
So far, there have been no reports of the bird flu found in Wisconsin cows, reports the Capital Times. About one in five retail milk samples in the United States had virus fragments in them, according to a report the Food and Drug Administration released last week. But the positive results were primarily from regions where herds had been affected by the virus. A new federal order requires that lactating dairy cows be tested for bird flu before being transported across state lines in an attempt to curb the spread of the disease. Milk from sick cows is entirely safe for human consumption as long as it has been properly pasteurized.
Centro Hispano, a Dane County nonprofit that focuses on providing support to the Latinx community, opened a new facility last Friday at its location on the corner of Hughes Place and Cypress Way on Madison's south side. The nonprofit hopes the new building will help them serve an additional 1,000 community members each year, reports the Capital Times. The new facility includes spaces for childcare as well as an additional classroom space. The building is a product of a $20 million capital campaign. The money will go to expanding the workforce and educational programming of the organization.
The Madison Police Department is 2 weeks into its pilot program on the north side to deploy body cameras. And so far, the reception from police officers is positive, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Madison has been considering using body cameras since 2015, when the city created a citizens' commission to study their use and ultimately advised against their deployment. This most recent pilot program was approved last year and is scheduled to last 90 days. While the program is popular with police officers, activists have expressed worries that the footage will be used to increase prosecutions of low-level offenses. Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes expressed skepticism that the city would ultimately adopt the use of body cameras, saying that the results of the pilot program are unlikely to be persuasive either way.
This weekend was the 55th Mifflin Street Block Party, with about 10,000 students in attendance, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The party started in 1969 as a spring hangout without official sanction and has since spiraled into an infamous venue for excessive drinking. This year, more than 80 people were arrested at the party, mostly for violating alcohol laws. 11 people were hospitalized. A first floor deck collapse was reported, as well as a car being flipped over and another car being damaged during this weekend's festivities.
A new taco and tequila restaurant is slated to open on Monroe Street early this May, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Taberna Tacos and Tequila is planning on opening in the building that formerly housed the Burke and Benham Seafood Market. The restaurant will be run by the owner of Pasquale's, which has several restaurants across Madison, but this one will be more focused on being a taco sports bar. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
This morning, a crowd of UW-Madison students and community members rallied on Library Mall in solidarity with Gaza. And some of them plan to camp there until university leadership meets their list of demands. Our news producer, Faye Parks, headed over this afternoon and spoke to some folks on the ground.
Early this morning, hundreds of demonstrators gathered on Library Mall to protest in solidarity with Gaza. By the time I arrived in the early afternoon, the crowd was more subdued. Organizers with UW-Madison's Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, held a safety meeting, set up tents, and amassed a pile of water bottles and snacks. That's because they aren't planning on leaving anytime soon. SJP, with the support of several local orgs, has set up a, quote, liberated zone, unquote, on Library Mall. And they say they plan to stay until UW-Madison leadership agrees to a list of their demands.
Would you state your full name for me?
Dahlia Saba. I'm a member of SJP.
So could you walk me through why you're here today? What are you hoping to accomplish?
I'm here today because we have seen over 6 months of genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza, as well as decades of injustice and occupation against the Palestinian people broadly. So we're here today to demand that University of Wisconsin-Madison finally end its complicity in this violence being perpetuated against the Palestinian people.
And what would that look like? Who are you hoping they divest from?
So we have a list of companies from the American Friends Service Committee. This includes companies that are complicit in occupation, complicit in funding and providing technology for prisons, that help, you know, provide technology and weapons for the border. So we are out here today to demand that the university divest from all of those companies.
And I saw as well you're asking that UW police leave campus. They no longer have a presence here. Can you walk me through that?
We've seen at other campuses across the country that police have been used as a weapon against students. They do not make students more safe. In fact, they make students less safe. And we have seen at UW-Madison that the administration has used the threat of police to try to stop students from speaking their mind about the way that their own money is being used. So we think that the university is continuing to fund its own police force that harasses students is unacceptable.
I know, too, you know, UW-Madison was a leader in protest, especially during the Vietnam War. We see that arrests and occupations have already happened at Columbia University. There was the circumstances in California. Why has the student organization pushed back this movement for so long? Was it to wait until after the Mifflin Street Block Party? Do you know?
You know, we are working based on, you know, what works makes the most sense for our own campus. But we are here in solidarity with the people of Palestine and to further this student uprising. The student uprising, we don't see as something that lasts a day or a week. This is something that we hope will carry on, you know, and permanently change the way that universities work with their investments and change the way that universities are accountable to students.
So I see that folks are set up to stay for a long time. I see tents, chairs, that kind of thing. Do you plan to stay here until UW responds?
We plan to stay indefinitely, and how long that is depends on how the UW responds to our demands.
Have you heard from them at all or from UWPD?
I can't speak really to that communication.
And has there been a strong police presence? I see some over there, a couple. Were there more during the rally this morning, or has it been pretty consistent?
There has been a consistent police presence. I don't know exactly how many people are here. We know that the university has threatened us with police violence, but we are here for the people of Palestine, and we are prepared to face risks because fighting for justice for them is the fight for justice everywhere in the world.
And have there been any threats of expulsion, anything like that, from UW leadership that you know of?
We have not heard of any specific threats.
Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I just want to add that the University of Wisconsin-Madison claims to be a public institution, but it funnels its money through the UW Foundation, which is a private institution and completely unaccountable to both students and taxpayers. We find this unacceptable, and as students who care about Palestine, the people of Palestine, and care about our, you know, money not being used for violence, we demand that the UW divest from these companies that perpetuate violence at the border in Israel and in prisons.
So my name is Jules, J-U-L-E-S, and that is a pseudonym. So we're here today because there's an ongoing genocide against Palestinians, and UW-Madison is complicit in this genocide. We demand that UW-Madison divest from occupation, borders, and prisons from Palestine to Dajob, the Ho-Chunk land that the university occupies here. We will keep protesting until our demands are met.
I understand that there's been some communication with the university, some warnings not to do something like this. Does that concern you, the police presence, that kind of thing?
I'm much more concerned about the 34,000 and counting Palestinians that Israel has killed thus far.
Is there anything else you'd like to add? Anything I haven't touched on?
I would just invite people to come out, share food, learn from the teach-ins that are going to be happening, and come build community with us.
But not everyone on campus supports SJP's mission. A smaller group of students gathered on a grassy hilltop away from the tents. And one of them, who self-identified as a Zionist and counter-protester, said he was disappointed to see so many of his classmates join the pro-Palestine movement. Halsey Hazard, a member of Young Democratic Socialists of America, said they're not concerned about the counter-protesters.
I think that they're just kind of there. They'll be there. They can do whatever they want. I know what we've said internally and what we're hoping that everyone who joins us at the encampment today knows is that we are here to share our message, to make our demands, to raise our demands, and to free Gaza and to stop this genocide. And we are not interested in engaging with people that want to stop that or make that more difficult or oppose what we're doing. Because we believe that what we're doing is right. And I think those people are not worth our time. I'd like to add that we are feeling really great and really excited and really emboldened by the amount of people that have shown up. We've got like hundreds of people that are here. We had way more earlier, and people have obviously like gone away for class and things, but we've been overwhelmed by the amount of support from community members, from faculty, from staff. People really agree with this cause, and they support students' right to peaceful protest, to free speech on campus. And we've just been really emboldened by that and really happy for that, and really energized to continue this fight in whatever form it may take, right? And we don't know exactly what form that's going to take, but everyone here today is committed to freeing Gaza, freeing Palestine in our lifetime, and to ending this genocide and to having an immediate ceasefire as soon as possible.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
Over the weekend, a great festival came to Madison. Not talking about Mifflin, it's the Great Midwest Alpaca Fest and the Wisconsin Alpaca and Fiber Fest that brought together dozens of alpaca farmers and fiber workers for a celebration of the alpaca products and personality. Reporter Jess Miller spoke to some of the most prominent members of the country's alpaca community to find out what makes these animals so special.
This past weekend, the New Holland Pavilion at the Alliant Energy Center played host to farmers, vendors, and over 300 alpacas, the smaller, fuzzy cousin of the llama prized for their soft fleece, for an annual double show, the Great Midwest Alpaca Fest and the Wisconsin Alpaca and Fiber Fest. At the event, alpacas are judged dog show style, 50% based on their physical conformation to accepted standards.
And the other 50% is, of course, on the fiber.
Wade Geese is known as the Alpaca Guy and runs a business of the same name. He was a vendor at the weekend show, but he's also one of the country's senior alpaca judges.
Like if you listen to the judge's reasons, they'll be saying, you know, this is what separated these two, and that's why this animal is first over second. It might be a density aspect, that it's just producing more fiber because it's more dense. And one might be a conformational placement, you know, its legs are tight in the back and it's not quite in balance. You know, it's got good fleece, but it needs some help conformationally.
Geese got his start as a co-owner of an alpaca ranch in the 1980s when the animals were marketed as a profitable livestock breed. But most folks I talked to had somewhat less pragmatic reasons for taking up alpaca farming.
I always blame my wife, you know, because I wanted larger animals. She said, oh, try alpacas. And she knew nothing about it. She thought they were cute. Well, yeah, they're cute.
Mark Shilcox, the show coordinator, worked on a family dairy farm and in a paper mill before starting Shilcox Shamrock Lines Alpacas. He was looking for something to occupy his retirement.
But you need to learn a lot to have them. And when I first got them, I worked 12-hour shifts, so I'd be getting up at 3:30 in the morning to take care of them before work. I didn't get home till 6:30 at night, so I ate supper and go out there. And you know, anybody gets tired when they work all day, right? But I get out there, and these animals, they give you the look like, where the heck you been, guy? We're hungry. And you know, and they still nuzzle you. They just made your day. So you feel cruddy until you get out there, and yeah, they're beautiful animals.
Marcus Skildum, the festival vice president and show manager, has been working with alpacas through his business, Mesa Trail Alpacas, for 10 years. Each year, he drives from Tennessee for the festival.
I got into it as kind of a joke to begin with. My wife was an RN. I was a plant electrician. She came home from work one day tired of just everything. She goes, I just want to quit my job, sell the house, buy a farm, plant a garden, grow our own food, raise alpacas, and knit our own clothes. And we laughed. A couple years went by, and it just kind of fell into existence.
Of course, alpacas aren't without their practical benefits. Alpaca fiber, says Geese, is one of the best natural fibers for clothing and other products.
Alpaca fiber is shown to be stronger than most other natural fibers. It does have a higher thermal retention, but yet it's really breathable, so you don't overheat, antimicrobial. Alpaca socks you could wear for 5 or 6 days in a row before you really need to wash them because it's just suppressing that bacteria growth.
But if you ask the farmers, you can't beat alpacas for personality. Marjorie Morak runs Greenbrier Farm and serves as the festival president.
They are a little bit more like a cat than a dog, but they are truly an intelligent being, and they're intuitive.
This is a little sweetheart. Come on, Artemis. Okay, now she's a little sweetheart. I mean, she's got the personality. You see her eyebrows or lashes? Okay, she's just calm as a cook. And I love this personality. You notice that bigger white one back there? She's a little higher strung. Okay, but she's a sweetheart. First time I took her in the ring when she was up this size, she was just nervous as heck. And I'd have to put her head on my shoulder. And you could just feel them melt, okay? That being afraid just melts right out of it.
Being cousins of llamas, there's one question Geese gets often.
It's, oh, will they spit at me? Alpacas aren't going to just come up and typically spit at someone. But they certainly can, you know, if they feel threatened, if they're approached too quickly.
Spit and all, it's those personalities that keep farmers like Mark Shilcox coming back for more.
So, I mean, this is how I fell in love with them when they're this age, okay? Because they just love you. Don't you, sweetie pie? Yeah, you're a good little girl. But yeah, this is good.
For WORT News, I'm Jess Miller.
Analysts say certain economic factors make it harder for workers of all ages to build a healthy retirement fund. But a new national survey has consumer advocates recommending people with plenty of working years ahead of them find ways to save more money for their golden years. Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
A new national survey says 1 in 5 Americans 50 and older don't have any retirement savings. Wisconsin workers, young and old, are urged to take action now to avoid added financial stress in their advanced years. The survey results were issued by AARP this month. Just affording basic expenses right now is a concern for many, but AARP's Jim Flaherty says you don't want to be caught off guard when retirement nears. He acknowledges it can be hard for younger adults to plan that far ahead when they're juggling expenses like student loan debt, or for older individuals managing costly medications and higher grocery bills.
A lot of times because they're just trying to get by, and they do have to live paycheck to paycheck. But this is one way to say, hey, if you can live with a little bit less from your paycheck every week, that will sure grow.
Researchers note that 57 million Americans don't have access to a retirement plan through their work. Wisconsin has not yet joined the list of states that have created state-operated retirement accounts where employers and their workers can contribute money each pay period. Supporters hope the issue is revisited next legislative session. Flaherty says a combination of individuals being proactive and policymakers easing household budget pressure can hopefully put more people on a path toward a healthy retirement. He says making progress can deter them from looking elsewhere to spend their golden years.
Let's have an infrastructure that makes drugs affordable, that makes healthcare affordable, that makes retirement savings something that's part of their plan, and that'll keep Wisconsinites here.
And groups like AARP have encouraged Congress to address long-term stability concerns for Social Security so that younger workers can anticipate full benefits. Some Republican lawmakers have floated cuts, but senior advocates contend that any solutions to make the program stronger should not be tied to deficit talks. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time now is 6:33 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Peggy West Schroeder is the executive director of FREE, a project that advocates for incarcerated women's right to dignity, support, and trauma-informed care. Yesterday, West Schroeder appeared on Her Turn, WORT's feminist news show, and told hosts Christina Kivlin and Garima Gupta about FREE's latest advocacy work.
So can you give us a brief introduction on your background and a little bit of your activism?
So I was born while my mom was incarcerated at Techira in 1970. And so that really has fueled my desire for women's incarceration to end in the state of Wisconsin, or severely decrease, at least in the United States. I would love to live in a community where we reimagined incarceration, instead allowed people healing and didn't send any, or at least not so many, women to prison.
Starting on the 23rd, you were in Washington, D.C. for the Free Her 10th Anniversary March. Can you tell us a little bit about that march and, you know, what exactly it was that you were marching for?
So we were in Washington, D.C. We participated in the National Council of Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. They had their 10th anniversary march. And the National Council also is a lot of times referred to as Free Her. And they do so many incredible things. And so 10 years ago, they held their first march and they called for an end to women's incarceration in the United States. They were calling on governors and the president to commute women's sentences and to send them home. And over the last 10 years, as you are probably aware, women's incarceration has actually increased in the United States and not decreased. And in 2023, when President Biden handed down his computations, he commuted 23 people's sentences, and none of those people were women. And so we were like, we've got to march so that we can draw attention to, again, to the fact that women do become incarcerated. Women's incarceration affects our whole community. When you incarcerate a woman and take her away from her children and her family and her job, you know, there's a ripple effect in our communities that lasts sometimes for generations. And I don't think that the powers that be give that impact enough thought. And so that's why we marched. We went to Washington, D.C., marched along with, we sisters from all over the United States. I think almost all of the states were represented. And each one of the states obviously has their own issues that they're working on. And just sending the message that there's so much work to be done with women's incarceration, and that if we could focus on women's incarceration and ending women's incarceration, we really feel like we could solve a lot of the problems that we have in society by bringing our mothers home.
Can you tell us just a little bit about what are some of the main reasons that women happen to be incarcerated? What are some of those statistics?
A major reason for women's incarceration actually is domestic violence. And at the federal level, they just passed a law that would allow for women who were incarcerated on domestic violence cases to be reevaluated and possibly released. The problem is that a lot of states aren't learning that law and applying it. And so we have women who are still incarcerated, but they're actually eligible to be released. So DV is a big driver of women's incarceration. The opioid crisis is a big driver of women's incarceration. Substance use disorder is a huge driver. And so again, our argument is if we can treat women in the community and help them to deal with the trauma that goes along with substance use disorder, that we would be able to then not have to incarcerate them. And the last big driver of women's incarceration is mental health. And again, I don't think anybody in our society can argue that we do mental health very well. It's often still very misunderstood. In Wisconsin prisons, about 63% of everyone who is incarcerated has a diagnosed mental health issue. And again, that means diagnosed. And I think that if we took the time to really diagnose people who are sitting in our prisons in Wisconsin, we would learn that that's probably a much larger number. Much research has been done to show, but anybody with mental health issues, prison is not the place for you. And unfortunately, with the attention that we've been receiving around the lockdowns going on in the men's prisons, we've also now learned that men and women who have mental health issues don't always receive the medication that they need while they're incarcerated. Their issues are not being addressed. And so it continues to perpetuate the cycle of returning to incarceration if we're not dealing with people and their needs.
You also got some youngsters from Milwaukee Trans Center for Youth, right? Can you talk some of their experience as well as some of your own?
Yeah, definitely. So we are involved with the Trans Center for Youth here in Milwaukee. It's four different alternative high schools. And we actually did a Know Your Rights training with them. We really want to focus more on youth and educating our youth on what goes on in the criminal legal system, because we often get asked, like, what's the best thing that we can do to end mass incarceration? And really the best thing you can do is to educate youth. Educate youth and also their parents, because we believe that we have a lot of protections in our society that we don't actually have. And so as a parent of young people, one of your main goals should be that your child knows their rights and that they know how to interact with the police and with the school officers. We have police right inside of your children's school who have access to them all day while they're away from you. And that should be very alarming to us. And so we have been working with them. We watched When They See Us, the documentary series, with them and had conversations with them about incarceration. And a lot of them obviously have lived experience when it comes to having an incarcerated parent or an incarcerated loved one, or they've had dealings with the police. And so because the Free Her 10th anniversary march really was focused on Mother's Day and trying to get a message out that we need our moms home, they really felt that message, and they were really excited to be in Washington, D.C. and marching alongside of us.
Can you also talk about how these issues of incarceration affect women of color differently?
Well, you know, African American and Indigenous women are the two largest populations of women that are incarcerated in the state of Wisconsin. And so on. Obviously, when you take a look at the whole pie, they're also two of the smallest groups.
Yeah.
And so we have the highest rates of incarceration among, you know, small sector. When you take a look at, again, we talked a little bit about the drivers of women's incarceration, but really, you know, one of the things is the lack of resources. And so obviously there's discrimination that happens with the court. People have biases regarding women of color. So we tend to get longer sentences for the same sentence as white women. But then there's also the economic aspect of that and the cost for having an attorney, the cost for having your own legal representation versus using a public defender. And some public defenders are phenomenal, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're actually paying for your defense, it's better. And so those are some of the things that we see in communities of color that are happening to our women versus women who don't share those same barriers. And so you do tend to unfortunately see more women of color being incarcerated. And again, for basically the same crimes. We're not committing different crimes. It's the same crime. It's just being handled differently.
That was Peggy West Schroeder, the executive director of FREE. Check out WORT's online archive to hear the rest of her conversation with the Hurricane crew. Today, April 29th, is the anniversary of Coeur d'Alene's Bunker Hill bombing during a miners' strike in 1899. The bombing was part of a long, violent campaign where the forces of the state and the corporations came down on the miners, and they fought back every way they could. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
Today, April 29th, is the anniversary of Coeur d'Alene's Bunker Hill bombing during a miners' strike in Idaho in 1899. The bombing destroyed a non-union metal ore mill, burned multiple homes and outbuildings. Two people died in the crossfire. It was followed by a military occupation. The next day, all the town's 1,200 men, miners and non-miners alike, were arrested and put into outdoor bullpens. Some were held for months. The region's underground lead and silver mines represented the very worst of the industrial system, according to J. Anthony Lucas, who wrote a book on the period titled Big Trouble. It's on my list. 7 years prior, in 1892, there had been a lockout, wage cuts, scabs, and other provocations that caused miners to take over trains, fire on scabs, threaten to blow up non-union equipment. The Republican governor called in the National Guard and got federal troops to end the state of insurrection and rebellion. They arrested over 600 strikers and held them in outdoor bullpens under miserable conditions for more than 2 months without any hearings or formal charges. The leaders were convicted of contempt of court and criminal conspiracy. The defeat led the Idaho miners to join previously independent unions together, forming the Militant Western Federation of Miners, WFM. They also joined the Great Populist Upsurge, which pledged to give government power to the farmers and the workers. In 1896, working-class voters turned northern Idaho into a populist stronghold by aggressively taking up the cause of the embattled miners and capturing all the county offices. In the gubernatorial race, Democrats, populists, and organized labor backed the fusion candidacy of newspaper owner and former union printer Frank Studenberg, while the populist William Jennings Bryan lost the presidency to William McKinley. Studenberg won Idaho by the biggest margin in its history. That victory made the populists and miners' union even more determined to wrest economic control from the mine owners. But the alliance quickly frayed when the governor refused to disband two National Guard units drawn from the anti-union workers of the Bunker Hill Company, the region's most determined enemy of organized labor. On April 29, 1899, hundreds of armed miners commandeered a train to take them to Bunker Hill. They arrived and blew up the Bunker Hill Company's key ore concentrator, one of the world's largest at the time, worth $250,000. Under pressure from worried mine owners, Governor Studenberg wired President McKinley requesting federal troops. One of the regiments was carefully picked, black veterans of the Spanish-American War, who wouldn't bond with the unruly white rioters, mainly Irish, Cornish, Italian, and Scandinavian. The soldiers conducted house-to-house searches at bayonet point and made mass arrests of anyone with a criminal history. Soon 1,000 men were in bullpens, just like 7 years before. Idaho's Attorney General put the area under martial law and required work permits, effectively banning WFM miners. The state sent 10 men to San Quentin for hijacking the train, and one boxcar rider got 17 years at hard labor. After several months, all the others in the bullpen, never charged with anything, were released. 6 years later, former governor Frank Studenberg was assassinated by a dynamite bomb triggered by opening the side gate to his yard at home. The state quickly arrested a strange drifter, Harry Orchard, who confessed under severe abuse by infamous Pinkerton James McParland to a years-long campaign of mayhem and murder, all allegedly masterminded by Big Bell Haywood, Secretary-Treasurer of the WFM, President Charles Moyer, and former union leader George Pettibone. State officials and the bosses conspired to convict and hang all three men as an example to their followers. The three were nowhere near Caldwell when the assassination took place. The Pinkertons did not worry about extradition. They just had them all kidnapped and shipped them from the WFM Denver headquarters to Idaho with cooperation from a railroad baron. After a year in jail, Big Bill Haywood was the nation's most notorious prisoner. President Roosevelt declared him an undesirable citizen. Fortunately for Haywood, Harry Orchard was a poor prosecution star witness, and in a closing argument that lasted 11 hours, Haywood's lawyer, Clarence Darrow, called on jurors to side with the toilers of the mines, mills, and on the farms of this country. The appeal succeeded because many of Idaho's farmers had been deeply moved by Haywood's determination to fight for poor, the weak, and the weary. According to author Lucas Moyers and Pettibones, charges were subsequently dismissed as well. And that is our story for today. For the past and the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
This week, WORT's Charlie Bielowski teaches us about the sweetest drink of the 80s, the Sex on the Beach. We'll learn about the many iterations of the famous beverage and how its appearance in literature and movies brought it fame in the cocktail renaissance.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome back to Madison Mixology. Today I have for you another well-known drink that's recognized as an official cocktail by the International Bartenders Association. Today, I'll be teaching you how to make a proper Sex on the Beach. Unfortunately, the history surrounding the drink has been largely lost to time. From what word of mouth and the most common stories told suggest, the cocktail got its start in 1987 by an unnamed bartender who concocted it as part of a promotion from some liquor distribution company to sell peach schnapps. This bartender decided to blend some stuff together and eventually ended up with a mashup of a fuzzy navel, which uses peach schnapps and OJ, and a Cape Codder, which was vodka and cranberry juice. The end result was the Sex on the Beach. This supposed origin story does have one major flaw, however. In 1982, the American Bartender's School Guide to Drinks was published, and Sex on the Beach was included as a recipe in the book. Regardless of its true conception, the fruity sweet cocktail was quickly made famous after making an appearance on TGI Friday's cocktail list, and being name-dropped in the 1987 film Cocktail, starring Tom Cruise. Sex on the Beach's run would be short-lived, however, eventually falling out of favor due to the craft cocktail renaissance at the turn of the millennia. Despite its history, this half-forgotten gem still plays host to tropical dives and beach bars across the Western Meridian. This drink looks as neat as it tastes. First, start off with a highball glass and some ice. After that, add in about 1.5 ounces of vodka. Anything above rail quality is preferred. Then throw in 1/2 ounce of peach schnapps, and then 1.5 ounces each of orange juice and cranberry juice. From there, you can add in an optional 1/2 ounce of cream de cassis, but that's a matter of taste. And there you have it, a proper Sex on the Beach. Now to try it out. Very tropical. The blend of fruits is very nice, and as the peach schnapps kind of would suggest, it's very sweet as well. It brings out that kind of sweetness, which does very well at masking the alcoholic taste from the vodka. It reminds me a lot of the fancier screwdrivers that I tend to make when I do bartending myself. Not just like, you know, orange juice and vodka, but with the other additional things as well, like pineapple juice or cranberry juice or grenadine. The taste is... It's got this, you know, weird kind of like syrupy sweetness, I suppose. And I really credit that to the peach schnapps. Not saying it's bad, it's just a different type of sweet, I suppose. In 2008, the Mr. Boston Official Bartender's Guide made an alternate Sex on the Beach using cambrod, melon liqueur, and pineapple juice. But it still kept the cranberry juice and the vodka. It's one of many alternate drinks that you can make. Another one that's very well known is Sex on the Driveway, which cuts out the OJ and the cranberry juice and instead replaces it with blue curacao and Sprite. Gives it a nice blue hue. Or there's the non-alcoholic version called Safe Sex on the Beach, which doesn't use any vodka but uses all the other ingredients. As always, try them for yourself. And I'll be back next week for another episode of Madison Mixology. Reporting for WORT, I'm Charlie Bielowski.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews two movies on the small screen. First, the science fiction classic Starman. Harry says it's a fun, warm-hearted road trip romance. Second, a new film, Freud's Last Session, which is set in 1939 at the beginning of World War II. It imagines a meeting of the famous psychiatrist Sigmund Freud and author C.S. Lewis, where they debate the existence of God. Harry says it features another great performance by Anthony Hopkins playing Freud. Both films recently started streaming on Netflix.
Do you seriously expect me to tell the president that an alien has landed, assumed the identity of a dead house painter, and is presently out tooling around the countryside in a hopped-up 1977 Mustang?
That was clipped from the trailer for Starman, one of the sweetest love stories sci-fi movies ever. It came out in 1984, but has recently started showing on Netflix. Starman was directed by John Carpenter. Jeff Bridges is our innocent, curious alien who is shot down over northern Wisconsin by the U.S. military. Looking for a safe place to hide, he comes upon an isolated cabin where a young widow, Jenny Hayden, Karen Allen, is still mourning. Our wandering alien takes in the small cabin's interior and turns the movie projector on. Jenny has fallen asleep in the bedroom. He takes a lock of her late husband's hair, and he grows into an exact duplicate of her dead husband right in front of a freaked out Jenny. She also has a gun, but doesn't have the heart to use it. Our Starman has replicated her husband so she won't feel a little bit jumpy, he explains. He kidnaps Jenny to help him get across country to Arizona to meet up with his people. He has little choice, unprotected in the Earth's atmosphere, so much different than his. He is slowly dying. If that weren't critical enough, they have to stay one step ahead of area law enforcement and the military. In titular charge of the chase is Mark Sherman, Charles Martin Smith, as a GS-11 SETI worker on detachment to the military. He's disturbed by the military's plans for the alien, saying at one point, "Forget morality, how about good manners? We invited him here." Mark has pulled from the spaceship a record NASA sent out years earlier on a Voyager 2 mission. Jenny and Starman race across the country. In a pivotal moment, he decides to revive a dead deer on the hood of a hunter's car with predictable results. The hunter and his friends are outraged, and Jenny comes to the rescue. All in all, a very enjoyable, warm-hearted road trip romance sci-fi story with good special effects, but most appealing for the chemistry between Starman's two leads, Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen. Up next, a new film with one of our finest actors.
Why does religion make room for science, but science refuses to make room for religion?
Oh, please, you're breaking my heart. Because they hide behind their ignorance. You hide behind your ignorance.
That was a clip from the trailer for Freud's Last Session, directed and co-written by Matthew Brown. It's based on a 2009 play by Marc St. Germain. The movie and play take as their starting point the established fact that toward the end of his life, Freud, living in London, was visited by an Oxford Don. There's no proof that the Don was C.S. Lewis, but it could have been. This is a richly imagined story. It's September 3rd, 1939, the day Britain declared war on Nazi Germany after Germany's invasion of Poland. Freud, the great Anthony Hopkins, and his daughter have escaped the grip of the Nazis and ended up in London the year before. The author, C.S. Lewis, Matthew Good, comes for a visit. The two come together to discuss whether or not God exists. But the chaos of the outer world, on the edge of war, clearly forms the background of the story and intrudes at several junctures, most dramatically when an air raid is called and they are forced to take refuge in a nearby church basement. Lewis, a veteran of World War I, panics at the prospect of going downstairs. This was called shell shock then, what we call PTSD now. Freud calms him down so they can get to safety. In a way, this is only fair since Lewis has helped the gravely ill Freud walk the short distance. With the false alarm over, Freud quizzes Lewis on the different church statues. Later conversations show Freud more familiar with church customs and prayers than would first seem apparent. Freud says he was raised by a deeply religious nanny who took him to church on Sundays. In one terrifying, amusing flashback, Freud's father reacts angrily upon seeing his son make the sign of the cross. He abruptly kicks out the nanny and declares there is no heaven. He orders his son, "Never pray for me." Some of Lewis's flashbacks are dramatic. He recalls his time in the trenches. Lewis had been an atheist himself for years. The two argue, with neither changing the other's mind, but come to know and challenge the other. Freud is suffering from the pain of his cancer. He's running low on morphine, and his daughter, Anna Freud, Liv Lisa Fries, is called away from teaching to find medication for him as all the pharmacies and other stores close early. She's in a near panic state, and we learn much about her and her relationship with her father, her boss, and her lover in a few short scenes. But the main reason to see the film is the fine performance by Anthony Hopkins as Freud. Hopkins, now 86, has lost none of his acting chops. Matthew Good does a fine job as his foil, C.S. Lewis. Freud's Last Session just started playing on Netflix. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Jess Miller was your reporter. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson, her turns Christina Kivlin, Garima Gupta, and Joanne Powers, Charlie Bielowski, and Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production, Bill Kingsbury for web production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Sholly Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcasts. You can subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, The Access Hour. Have a great night.